Hi, everybody. This is John Cooper with KOSU and the Spy, talking today with David Macias, who is the one of the co-founders of 30 Tigers out of Nashville, Tennessee, and various other cities around the country. Hi, David.
Yes. Hey, how are you?
Thanks for coming in today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Having a wonderful time.
Good.
In Oklahoma City.
Well, good deal, man. I know you've had 30 Tigers for quite a while now. I think 2002 was the start.
Well, 2001.
2001,
actually,
yeah. Okay.
So just celebrated our 15th anniversary this year, and seems crazy that in certain ways it just seems like just yesterday that it started, but yet it wasn't.
So. Okay, man. Of course, time flies whether you're having fun or not.
Exactly.
Right? What were your early influences? What did you listen to? What got you into music to begin with?
I wish it were probably a little cooler than that, but I it's about 6 or 7 years old. I fell madly in love with Olivia Newton-John.
And, that's okay.
And so it was. I was very into like Olivia Newton-John and John Denver from a very young age, and then probably around in my when I turned 10 or 11, started to, pour through the encyclopedia of rock and memorized all the members of Black Sabbath. And, just kind of music was my thing, that's, I poured all my energy into and would ask for albums from my family for, Christmas and my birthdays and stuff like that. So I was just a music junkie right from the, right from the very beginning. And,
sure.
And tried to, be musical myself, but in my late teens, but it was I wasn't so good, and so I decided that I would try to allow my creativity to flourish on the business side of things, and so I started working in record stores when I was 15, and I've done nothing but work in the industry since then.
Oh, that's great, man. And don't apologize for Olivia Newton-John. Everyone has an entry point, whether it's, no matter where it is.
She was lovely.
Oh, absolutely.
Is lovely to this day.
Sure, of course. What were your first forays into the music? You worked at record stores.
Yeah, I worked record retail for the first 6 years. The record store where I would, go and buy all my records when I was just there one day. And the manager of the store was complaining that the interview person she was going to interview for seasonal help didn't show up for the interview. And I was like, well, I'll do it. Well, I could kind of get discounts on records. She was like, absolutely. And so thus began my my music business career. And and then I did that for 6 years, moved to Atlanta. I was continuing to work in retail there. And then at 21, went to work for Arista Records.
Okay.
And where I spent, 15 years of my life sort of, working for Arista, both on the pop side of things and then for Oki, music hero Tim Dubois.
Oh, yeah.
Worked with Tim at Arista Nashville for the last 8.5 years of my time at the major label world.
Right. Well, of course, Oklahoma Music Hall of Famer Tim Dubois.
Yes,
he's regarded very highly around these parts,
as he should be.
Yes, no doubt about it. So you're working for Arista, and then what years was? When did you?
Well, it was
your final year there.
2000. They kind of merged into RCA. It was right at the beginning when a lot of consolidation was happening, and rather than trying to sort of jump into another label situation, I decided that what I would do is, form my own company. I did it with a fellow Arista alum named Deb Markland. And we started this company with the idea that, that at that time, not only was the music industry or the label world was shedding a lot of executives doing startups but a lot of independent artists were out there, bands like the Great Divide, who was one of the first people, that was the very first record that we put, through our first distribution deal with, Sony Red, Susie Boggess, people like that, who could sell, enough records, but, just that the major label world that just didn't make sense for one another. But one of the impediments for you know, for acts. I mean, it was, you know, one of these things where these startups or the individual acts to hire their own sales and marketing people, it made it financially unviable for them to sort of own that infrastructure. So, you know, my partner and I, what we decided to do was work for, you know, rather than have one person hire us for $50,000, have 10 people hire us for $5,000, you know,
right.
And so we could sort of, you know, and these startups didn't need a full-time sales and marketing person. So it kind of worked for where the industry was at, as it was kind of, they were shedding artists and,
sure.
and people. And so, you know, so I'm thankful that we got our, you know, we got our start. I don't, you know, I'd love to proclaim that, you know, I had great vision for where everything was heading, but it just seemed sensible at the time. And as time, you know, went on, and a year after that, when in 2002, we signed a distribution deal directly with Red, Sony's independent arm, and mm-hmm. were able to provide distribution as part of our offering of services.
I know you started your business with you and Deb mm-hmm. in your house in a back bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
How was it to grow that business? What were some of the early highs and lows and successes and failures?
Actually, the Great Divide was both a high and a low.
I love those guys, by the way. They're great
yeah.
friends of ours.
No. I'll tell you what. I mean, I am in awe of. I mean, I think you know Mike McClure is just one of.
Oh,
he is a treasure.
Wow.
And just a true musical. Genius. But it was right at the time when the band was kind of breaking up, and so we put the record out and found out like weeks later that the band wasn't going to be together anymore. And so we had all this on our first record, all this potential liability out into the field. And this was in the days before digital. I mean, there was no iTunes then. And so,
right.
so all of a sudden I'm thinking like, oh my God, we're going to wind up getting all these returns back. And it was, I thought we're sunk before we even start, you know, it's just like, you know, so that was a very, that was a huge existential crisis. And, and we made it through that, but certainly in the early days, I think some of the early, big wins, but the positive thing was, you know, they're such a well-respected band, and that album Afterglow is just a fantastic record. And,
absolutely.
And it was a real great thing for us to represent a band that was as well-regarded and all that. So that was, there was a plus and a minus in that. I undertook producing my first record. I decided that I wanted to tell the story of, Stephen Foster and, put an album of his songs, various artists putting songs together, and then you know that came out in 2004 and did incredibly well, and you know wound up winning a Grammy for that, and,
nice.
And that was a huge high point for the company in every way, but also for me having a sense that I actually could that I had some chops on the creative side. I mean, my background was really more like going into Walmart and selling Alan Jackson and Brooks and Dunn records, you know? And so that was, that gave me a license and a little bit more confidence to, feel like I had some contributions to make in terms of, the creative side of things. And,
okay.
and I think gave artists a lot more confidence in my abilities, in that realm. And so that was a definite, very early high point.
Nice. Let me ask you this about the artists that you choose, how are your artists selected? Can they pick and choose from what's offered by 30 Tigers?
Not really.
Okay, it's all, that's just one package or?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, we're for all intents and purposes, we're their label, you know.
Okay.
In that we provide, you know, funding to the degree that we feel like we can, funding for the entire enterprise, the advocacy and infrastructure and expertise that labels can provide, and also the distribution channels, both through our partners with you know Sony in the States and in Europe and through Cooking Vinyl in Australia and New Zealand and so it's it feels very much like being with a label. Where we're not like a label is that we don't own anyone's work. We don't own any masters. You know, we don't even license them. So artists own their work right from the beginning of the process. They keep 75% of the gross. They keep 100% of what they sell on the road. They keep 100% of master use licenses. So it can be a very remunerative situation. It can give artists a lot more freedom if they actually own their recordings, and you know they can have control over what they're doing. Now, you know, from our end, in terms of how we select those artists, you know, because we're earning essentially about, you know, 10 to 12% of the remaining 25% of the gross, we're keeping about 10 to 12% of that, you know, to pay for our staff and just to do the things that we do, to act as their quote unquote, you know, I know you can't see me out there in radio land making quotation marks with my fingers, but the label infrastructure. So, you know, we do have to be a little bit more cautious in terms of our risk, you know, capital. So sometimes for certain types of projects, especially where commercial radio is involved, and it's expensive to try to mount a national conversation through commercial radio formats. So sometimes, you know, it requires a situation where more risk capital is made available, you know, to the artist, and you know, our sort of model where, you know, the artist sort of keeps it on the back end is it doesn't allow us to take the risk, you know, needed. It's just not, you know, appropriate. And so sometimes we're not a good fit, you know, on that end of things. And, but also, you know, for, you know, certain other types of acts where, you know, where we have to, say acts that are going to be press driven. A lot of the artists that we work with here in Oklahoma, people like Samantha Crane and John Fulbright and Parker Millsap and John Moreland, those guys are largely going to be driven by press, and, they're not going to be driven so much by commercial radio. And so we have to feel like we understand how to tell their story through the press, and that we feel like there's a viable story there to be told. So, you know, if you know, NPR is going to talk about one of these artists on Morning Edition or All Things Considered, which is certainly something that we hope happens, we better feel before we sign them that we're confident that the artistic core of that artist is both, you know, identifiable and will make for good narrative, through the mediums that we're going to go and talk to them about it. And if we don't, you know, feel that way, if we sort of don't understand who the artist is and sort of how their artistic center emanates from them, then, you know, we're likely not to take it on, you know?
Sure.
And then, you know, we also work on, you know, with other, you know, acts where press isn't going to be quite as important, but we just, you know, whatever mediums are going to, help the, artists and their art be translated to the human beings that are out there that are going to, you know, buy their music and buy concert tickets and be their fan base. We just have to understand whether it's, you know, press, radio, social media, the live touring, whatever, you know, each of those are mediums, and whatever that media mix, we just have to feel like there's enough happening there that's going to really allow a robust conversation to happen there, and that we understand how to manage that conversation. If we don't, I mean, especially because we don't own anything, you know, one of our strong sort of values is the idea of a service mentality. We don't own anybody's work. We're there to serve them. If we don't have a strong vision about how to navigate that conversation, how are we being of service to them?
Right.
You know, so, so that's something that we, you know, we take very seriously.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the artists on your label. I know that you have Santana mm-hmm. on your label as well as Patty Griffin.
Yep.
Mavericks.
Yep.
John Doe. Those are some of my very favorite artists.
Yeah.
How do you approach them, as opposed to someone that's not as well known?
Well, I think, you know, we just sit down and you know, talk to them in the same way that we would talk to, you know, any artist about, you know, how, you know, going medium by medium and talking about how we would approach, you know, their work. I mean, the main thing is, you know, with artists is, you know, if we can, you know, if you know, my feeling is we'll get the job if we can make sure that the marketing of the record is going to be handled, you know, at the highest levels. And if we can do it in a way where, you know, the artists kind of get the lowest price every day for our service, you know, then we're going to get the job. And so I think in the instance, like with Santana, you know, their management was advised, you know, was, you know, they're through their publisher who we do have done a lot of work with. And, you know, we got a word of mouth referral when, you know, they were talking about what it is that they wanted to do. They were like, oh, well, you should talk to 30 Tigers. And so we sat down and, you know, had the conversation and, negotiated the deal, and it's been fantastic. It's been a, you know, the record's done, you know, really well, and they've been wonderful to work with. And I think that, you know, the more that we go on and people, you know, see that we can handle, you know, Santana and Lucinda Williams and Jason Isbell and Sturgill Simpson and things like that to the degree that we're able to, it just instills them with confidence that, you know, it's like, okay, well, these people know what they're doing. And, you know, so the more, it's definitely been the kind of thing where the more that we've gone on, you know, people are, you know, they're more comfortable and confident in our ability to do, you know, what we say that we can and will do. And of course, if there's things that we, you know, can't do, then, you know, or reasons why it won't work. Like, for instance, Nathaniel Ratliff and the Night Sweats, that's a great example of a good, honest conversation we had with the management, because, you know, we'd put out two Nathaniel records before, and the manager was like, well, we've got this, you know, big, you know, band album, and we need, you know, some tour support to be able to cover, get taking this 8-piece band around. And just the risk reward thing just didn't really, you know, it didn't fit. We would not have, he might have been underserved had he come right through us with the risk capital, not been able to tour to the degree that he needed to get that, you know, out, that music out into the world. And so a more traditional model was, I think, appropriate. And obviously it's worked really well. And by the way, we've sold a lot of Nathaniel Ratliff catalog in the meantime, because his whole standing has come up. And so, you know, we're very careful when we think that we're not the right home for somebody to say so. You know, we try to leave our customers happy. And so we never want to wander into anything where, you know, it's kind of like, well, maybe that'll work, you know. So, and through the years, as we've been growing, we've been very diligent about adding staff to, you know, we're now up to 27 employees. And so it's, you know, we've got enough infrastructure to be able to, you know, to really go out there, you know, in the same way that any label, you know, would, and, mm-hmm. and do the job. Most people just think we're a straight label. It's only the sort of the risk reward. It's the back end business relationship. It's the ownership of the work is where we're differentiated from right. other right. quote unquote labels,
which is a big change from the way major labels work yeah. for many years.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and honestly, there's a lot of Sam Walton in my philosophy terms of the sort of giving the artist the lowest price every day, or giving our customer, who is the artist, the lowest price every day. You know, all of our employees have insurance, though.
There you go.
I want to make sure I differentiate us from Sam Walton in that way. Not that, you know, whatever. Sorry.
Sorry, Sam.
Don't need to go down that road. I have a lot of respect for Sam Walton and what he built. But, you know, but in that way where he wrung all the inefficiencies out of the sort of the supply chain. I know, you know, this may be a big shock to everybody, but there are a decent amount of inefficiencies in the music business. And so by wringing those out and sort of passing the savings along to the artists, you know, once again, that's what really gets us, you know, the job and the fact that we approach it from a service standpoint. I mean, I do think that, you know, the thing that is of value in this entire equation, the thing that the reason why consumers spend money doesn't have to do with the company that delivers the music. It has to do with the art and the artist. And that is the product. That is the very center of everything. And that we, I think probably more than most business entities, put that at the center of the conversation. And with our business model, affirm that, you know, that the artist is at the center of everything, and we are there in humble servitude to that artist, as opposed to us being the sort of the you know, the monolith trying to grab intellectual property assets. It's just like, why wouldn't artists want to be attracted to that? And if we can make it work as Sam Walton made it work by you know, working efficiently, then we can, you know, we can be that kind of a transformative business that, sure. that Walmart was.
Well, as someone who's been on both sides of it, I can appreciate that to a great extent, man. I mean, you're nothing without the artist, and that's just the way it is. And you know that. And
I do know that. And you know, and you know, I think, and I think a lot of times it's a little maddening to the artist too, to you know, to go into this situation where you know, they mine, you know, through their natural empathy, you know, you know, they dig down deep and they, you know, come out and they share insights and they share, you know, their incredibly great gifts. And then to sort of throw it into, you know, a business environment that really doesn't put that empathy at the center of the conversation. It's disheartening.
Sure.
You know?
Of course.
And it's not always so binary. I mean, believe me, I think, you know, when I worked at Arista, and, you know, under, you know, Tim Dubois, you know, the business model was fairly typical, but there was a lot of, you know, love. There was a lot of, you know, the idea of service and all that. I mean, a lot of what shaped me was being in that experience. So it's not such a, you know, I don't mean to portray it as such a binary thing. There's really wonderful people. I mean, I think about, you know, like Nonesuch Records, who are great, you know, supporters of the arts. They have incredibly great taste, and they're in the Warner family, but it's, you know, artists feel understood there and everything like that. So that's not, you know, I don't mean to imply that it's such a binary proposition.
No. You have a pretty good roster from right here in Oklahoma.
Yes, we do. You know, both in the kind of the red dirt world, working with the Jason Bolins and the Turnpike Troubadours, to, you know, I think a lot of the song, you know, singer songwriters that, you know, kind of come through the, you know, the more of the kind of Woody Guthrie, Jimmy Webb, you know, prism, people like, you know, John Fulbright, John Moreland, Parker Millsap, you know, Samantha Crane is somebody we're like super, you know, proud of. She's amazing.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, so it's been, I mean, Oklahoma is just an amazing repository of like talent and artists. And I feel, you know, really lucky to, you know, to be at the service of so many, you know, great ones.
Right. And I know you learned that from Tim Dubois, because he's, of course, from Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And had lots of Oklahomans on Arista at the time.
And I think, you know, definitely working with him gave me a better, you know, sense of understanding that. But, you know, but even you know, even as I was sort of, you know, before, you know, even before I worked for Arista, I think, you know, just in terms of people like, you know, Woody Guthrie and Leon Russell and, you know, I mean, you know, and Jimmy Webb and people like that. I mean, I was well aware that, you know, that this incredibly, you know, rich river of song and talent, you know, flowed through here, you know, I was, you know, I think I was, you know, well aware of that right from there, because it was such a music head for, you know, for so long. And then, you know, you have, you know, an amazing band like the Flaming Lips, who, you know, come out of here, who are they're just their own, you know, thing. And it's just like, and I think that a lot of, I don't know, there seems to be, you know, I was talking about this a little bit earlier. I don't know if it's, you know, sort of through the kind of the pioneer spirit or whatever, but there seems to be a lot of, you know, people that they're very, you know, they're very artistically brave. They're very, very confident to sort of be there, you know, to speak from their own point of view and their own voice. They're creating from the inside out, not necessarily from the outside in. And and I think, you know, some of my favorite Oklahoma artists, I think, are the ones that are definitely inside out artists. And not that sort of creating for the marketplace, you know, which is kind of outside in, that there's anything wrong with that. And certainly there's been a lot of you know, artists in you know, that have come out of Oklahoma, in terms of, you know, Reba McEntire and Toby Keith and Garth Brooks, who have had enormous commercial success. And you know, and I honor that too. We do a lot on the commercial side too, you know,
sure.
But it's, you know, but certainly I think in terms of the, you know, kind of the there being a rich culture, I mean, it's just, the amount of amazing music that's come out of Oklahoma has just been, it's awe-inspiring.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I do want to ask you before we get out of here, what's your take on the streaming services, and how are they affecting music sales and the way that artists are presenting their music?
Well, that's a...
I know it's a big question.
That's a big question. And I have definitely been on record as being very pro streaming. I think, well, there's two questions there in terms of the presentation of the work and then the monetization. The monetization is a completely fair business model that even though it takes away from quote unquote sales, it doesn't take away from the monetization of the music. It's just a different, it's a different way to be monetized. It would be, you know, I mean, everything in the music business has been in a straight one-on-one transactional basis. I want to go see, you know, a band in concert. I'm going to pay $20. I'm going to go in and have that experience. I want to buy this album. I'm going to pay $15. I'm going to get that CD and I'm going to take it home and I own it. It's just, everything has been this sort of one-on-one transactional type of thing. And streaming is really more switching to the utility model, you know, so you're paying by the month and then you and all the other users are, your money is pooled and then it's all split out pro rata. The reason why I feel like I know that it's a healthy ecosystem when it moves from sort of a transactional acquisitional type of business model to a utility model is looking at Sweden. You know, Spotify represents 85% of all commercial music revenues in Sweden. If streaming were going to hurt an entire ecosystem, it would show up in Sweden. And in fact, just the opposite has happened, is that revenues have continued to climb, you know, as streaming has really taken hold. Mm-hmm. So I'm convinced that it's a solid business model and artists are not getting ripped off by participating in the streaming model. 100% convinced of that. And there's some advantages too, in that I think that it brings down, if somebody is, if it brings the barrier to consuming your music down where there's not the, you know, sometimes you'll read in a review or something, you'll be like, oh, I want to check that out in the old days. And if you were like, oh, well, I got to pay $15 to go sort of take the plunge, you may not take that plunge. Whereas if you start streaming, and there have been many artists where I've started listening to their music because I read something or read a review or whatever, and I've become fans because the barrier to consuming their music has been brought down to virtually nothing. So I think that can be a plus as well. The downside, I think, is in the sort of the disaggregation of artistic intent. You know, when an artist, often artists are, you know, they're making albums, they're making holistic statements, and when you know, the song can be sort of pulled out of the flow of the intent of the artist and put into playlists here or just, you know, these songs viewed independently there. I think it's harder for artists who have a more, you know, I think about Samantha's last album. I mean, there were songs that led, where ideas led from one to the other and all that. And by disaggregating the music and the intention, you know, and the intention of it being heard, then some of that is lost. On the whole, I'd rather just people be able to listen to music in the ways that they choose to listen to it. And so I'm definitely pro streaming, but I'm not without some recognition of it. It's not a completely uncomplicated thing,
right?
You know,
there's still stuff to be worked out for sure. The royalty thing is a problem with some.
I'd say songwriter royalties. I mean, artist royalties are not a problem.
Right.
I mean, artists get paid. The publishing side of the streaming services has been a bit of a problem, but it's not that the streaming services aren't paying. Like Spotify, you know, has been sued a couple times now. And frankly, though, Spotify is paying those royalties to a company which is owned by the music publishers, or I guess they actually just sold it to CSAC, but through the Harry Fox agency, there was this sort of thing that was put together and they said, oh, we'll be able to take care of all this. Well, they weren't. And so now publishing royalties are getting paid, you know, 3 years late, notices of intent are not being sent. It's a big mess. I mean, it's still, you know, it's kind of like, well, if, you know, if I don't wind up paying my federal income tax because my accountant is a you know, slacker and doesn't pay for 3 years, who's the government coming after? It's still my responsibility to make sure my taxes get paid. And so I have a lot of sympathy for the writers that aren't getting paid. On the whole, though, there's been pernicious stories being told about the streaming services and about how just people don't get paid, and this sort of reconciliation of artists of like, oh, well, you know, it's just a necessary evil. It's not. I mean, it's a good, solid business infrastructure, assuming that everybody, you know, in fact, gets paid. And I don't want to have the baby thrown out with the bathwater. But, you know, honestly, it kind of feels like that, you know, the streaming services are winning. People are moving over to that. And I think artists, as they see checks come in, I mean, I've had artists, you know, come to me and, you know, we're like, well, you know, should we take our music off Spotify? And I'm like, well, would you like to know how much you've earned on Spotify before you do? And some of them have been as much as $250,000. And it's kind of, they're like, oh, well, we had no idea. And I'm like, well, it's in your statements, but you know, but it's, you know, but they just have no idea that they're making that much money. And also, while that money's coming in, it's also, they're selling CDs to the people who want CDs, and they're selling vinyl to the people who want vinyl. And it's just however your customer wants to consume your product, as long as it's a fair business model, let them do it.
There you go.
And streaming is a fair model.
Okay. How do you see the future of the music business as far as the way the music is delivered, and which we've hit on pretty good here, but how do you see artist and management or the business side of it? Is it going to evolve any more than it has? Do you feel like your model is working well enough to where you're the model, or what do you see for the future?
You know, I think we might be the model. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, there has to be a tension between, you know, there's a middle ground between doing it yourself and then giving up ownership of your work and complete control over your artistic life to somebody who actually owns the intellectual property that are the recordings that you make. And, you know, but you still need, in order to mount a national conversation about your work and to be able to earn a profound living, you have to be able to have the advocacy and the expertise and the frankly the hearts, you know, and minds and bodies of people who believe in your work to go communicate that to the world. And so, you know, what I've tried to do is to find that middle ground where we can provide that advocacy and give artists and their managers, you know, power and control over their, you know, their destinies, and do it at the lowest price that we can possibly do it. And as a result, you know, it's turned into it's a pretty big business now.
Yeah.
And growing all the time. And, sure. And I'm very, you know, I'm grateful for that and gratified by that. And, you know, but, you know, I think, you know, where other parts of where the business is going to go, it's hard to say. I mean, I think so much of the business can, you know, is I think sort of music as a utility. I think you're going to see, you know, internet providers. I mean, a lot of the internet providers and cell companies and things like that. I mean, AT&T just, you know, negotiating to buy Time Warner, assuming that passes congressional approval and all that kind of stuff. And the idea is to be able to, I mean, the idea of content, artistic expression as content it's a little worrisome in that the commodification of artistic expression sort of, you know, I think it can potentially devalue it if it's just like, well, we're just going to turn on a hose and art's going to come out, you know, and you know, you people like art, right? And music and all that kind of stuff. It's a little, you know, so I worry a little bit about the tension of you know, kind of navigating all of that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but we'll just keep fighting the best fight we can, all of us, artists, us, everybody, and you know, we'll just all do the best that we can.
Absolutely. Well, David Macias with 30 Tigers, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. This is John Cooper with KOSU and the Spy.